S. Truman, President of the United States, dedicate this day of Sunday to America, firm and free.
If you seek liberalization, come here to this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, open this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
I am a minute man. I am the guardian of America, armed and free. For we knew it will always be the citizen who is the guardian of America, armed and free.
Welcome to America Armed and Free, a program dedicated to preserving your God-granted, constitutionally guaranteed individual right to keep and bear arms in defense of self or state, understanding that the citizens are the militia. This program is produced by Charles Heller and is not endorsed by anyone who isn't pro-choice on freedom.
We are the guardians of America, armed and free.
Indeed, we are the guardians of America, armed and free, both in uniform and not in uniform. And it is a joy, a pleasure, and an honor to welcome to the microphones and telephones of America, armed and free, a gentleman who has been in the uniform, spent 34 years in the uniform of his country, from starting out as a second lieutenant and ending out as a two-star, a major general, and also holds the Medal of Honor, the nation's highest award. It is a joy, a pleasure, and an honor to welcome you to the microphones and telephones of America, armed and free, General Patrick Brady.
A pleasure to be with you.
Yep, your third interview here, I believe. We talked originally about your Medal of Honor citation, and then about your second interview with us was about the organization that you're on the board of, about getting a constitutional amendment to protect the American flag. And now, of course, your third one about Dead Men Flying, Victory in Vietnam, The Legend of Dust Off, America's Battlefield Angels. And it's co-written with your daughter, who did a pretty good job, and I think she has a degree in journalism, no?
She does. Yes, indeed, she does. I blamed her for any grammatical errors or anything like that in the book.
Mm-hmm. I noticed you went with WorldNet Daily Books, which probably means it went to press a whole lot faster than if it had been with Simon & Schuster or one of the huge houses.
Well, yes, I think that's probably true. It did take a while, though. The book was originally published under another publisher some time ago, and then WorldNet Daily decided they wanted to republish it, and so they did. They designed a different cover, and they cleaned it up a little bit, and so it just came out in October, the new version.
Mm-hmm. And you flew Hueys, and mostly Hueys, although some H-19s as well, the old bubble-nose-looking Sikorsky. I was looking on the Internet, doing a little bit of background research on that H-19. You don't speak very highly of it. And I saw a 24-minute training video on how to pre-flight the bird and fly it and how to land it and all that. And the guy's uniform was even starched. I mean, it was a little too made up.
Well, the H-19 could kill you in a lot of different ways. And the first time I got into it, and I tell the story in the book as well, one of the ways is retreating blade stall, and the other is ground resonance. And we were just ferrying some birds back on our way back from the Dominican Republic from Fort Bragg down to Fort Benning, Georgia. And so I just went along for the ride. I didn't even know how to start. I'd never been checked out in it, but they wanted me as a co-pilot so the pilot could rest. And that thing went into retreating blade stall. We had it too far leaned out and too big a load, I guess, and it kind of turns up and goes right down at the ground backwards. And my co-pilot recovered it, and then we landed, and it went into ground resonance. We popped a tire, and that's when it gets a rhythm between the main rotor and the fuselage, and it beats itself to death, and transmission comes through the cockpit and kills everybody inside, but we managed to get out. But I had to fly that beast for a couple of years, and it made me a better pilot.
Yeah, you said it made you a better Huey pilot.
You bet. The Huey was the Cadillac or the Rolls-Royce. I mean, we came out with a jet engine. And the old birds that we flew, you had a motorcycle grip. Every time you moved a foot or an arm, you had to move your wrist. Took both feet, both arms, and a wrist to fly the old ones. With the Huey, you just kind of just 2 feet and two arms because the RPM was compensated automatically for you. And it was a great, great addition. And we would not have ever been successful in Vietnam in saving lives. I mean, if we got, good Lord, if we'd had to fly the H-19 over there, the H-34, one of those monsters with the reciprocating engine, the motorcycle grip, we would never, never have been able to do what we did in Vietnam.
By motorcycle grip, you mean the throttle? It turns the same way a motorcycle does. Only it turns with your left hand because you fly a helicopter from the right seat.
Well, you can fly a helicopter from the right or left seat if it has dual controls.
Right.
But it's all the motorcycle grip was in your left hand, and the interesting thing about it is it's the opposite of a motorcycle. On a motorcycle, when you add power, you turn it towards your body. And a helicopter, when you reduce power, you do that. And after flying the helicopter a few years, and I got on a motor, I never got on a motorcycle, I didn't fall off. I'd go to my cousin's ranch to chase the cows, and at about the critical point, I turned that damn thing the wrong way, and I ended up in a heap.
Yeah, you kind of lose momentum.
Yeah.
Why was humanitarianism our greatest victory in Vietnam?
Well, we didn't have, you know, of course, the Vietnam veteran, I hope people will say thanks to him today. He came back from that war with his tail between his legs. He was demonized by the elite in this country, the courtrooms, the classrooms, the cloakrooms, and the newsrooms. You know, they just went after the guy, tried to make him out to be a war criminal. And we didn't win the war. And Americans don't have much to do with losers. And so that's the way he came back, branded as a war criminal, and he lost. Truth is, he never lost a battle. Never lost a battle. Maybe the only war we ever fought where we never lost a battle. But it was also unique in another way. And this is kind of where the dust-off came in, the helicopter ambulances. That was our call sign, dust-off. We, in the heat of the battle, while we were trying to help the helpless people be free of the evils of communism, in the middle of all that, we were performing humanitarian acts. We were building medical facilities, orphanages. We were adopting those children. We were educating those children, vaccinating them. And we helped them with agriculture and any other thing where the GI could be helpful to those people. We cared, and they're wonderful people. We cared for them. We cared about them. And that's probably the first war we ever fought like that. Usually we go in and we bomb and strafe and kill, doesn't matter who, anything and everything in our way, civilians included. But not in Vietnam. And kind of the point of the spear and all that was the dust-off helicopter ambulances. I tell about how it got started in Vietnam, Charles Kelly, the great father of dust-off. But in the course of that war, they rescued close to a million souls, men, women, children, enemy, friendly, we didn't care.
Even dogs.
Scout dogs, yeah.
Yeah.
If you were hurt, we were going to come and get you. And that it was just that simple. Now, the people of Vietnam had never seen anyone care for them like that. They see this expensive machine coming into the rice paddies and villages to pick up their wounded, risking that machine and four American lives just to care for one of their wounded. It left a tremendous impact on them. And in my trips, when I go back, I'm treated like royalty, frankly. Especially by the young people there, and mostly in the South. It's a little gloomy in the North up in Hanoi, but in the South, Ho Chi Minh City used to be Saigon, and talked to the kids a lot, and they would tell me, of all the places in the world they would like to go, America was number one.
Hmm.
So
interesting to hear a former enemy's country say that, people in a former enemy's country say that.
Yes. It was, and the veterans too. When I meet with the veterans over there, the guys who fought us, the horrors of communism, what they did to those people after we left was just horrifying. They executed, they put them in an education camp. Some of them spent 10, 15 years in education camps away from their families. It was just horrible. But it's come around now. They've gone away from central ownership of everything to more decentralized. They've kind of opened it up to free enterprise. I see it when I'm back, especially, as I say, in Saigon or Ho Chi Minh City. I think communism is dead over there. They just don't know what to do with the corpse. It'll be a little while longer, and then we'll see.
They'll bronze it like Lenin's. It's interesting that you say that, because in the last few years I went to a Vietnamese restaurant, and there was a guy wearing a hat that said Vietnam veteran, and I asked him about his service. Turns out he was a North Vietnamese.
Really?
Yeah, he fought for the North.
And he
realized he was on the wrong side, and he ended up emigrating to the United States.
Good for him.
You don't see that in most countries. You don't see people who are your former enemies who are granted immigration visas and get here and get to that country they fought.
No, and it's, I think it's so important to realize that very difficult for, you know, guys like you and me, we're never going to change. And what those people in the North, the adults in the North, had been taught about us and about the French, too, you can't change them. You just got to fight them and sort it out. The only way you can change a country or a system, and this applies to, in my judgment, also to terrorists, you just got to kill them. And then you got to focus on the children and teach the children we are not the great Satan. Capitalism, free enterprise, is a great way to take care of poor people and to prosper. And once the young people grow up knowing that, then we'll have a peaceful world.
Mm-hmm.
But until that happens, we ain't gonna be. You know, all the all the sheep and chickens in the world would like for everybody to be vegetarians, but that ain't going to happen.
Yeah.
There's too many wolves out there.
Right.
So you got to focus on the young people.
The poor in this country are wealthy by international standards.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit. We got about 2 minutes before the first break. Who was Major Charles Kelly?
Charles Kelly was probably one of the most unique soldiers we ever produced. He was a veteran of World War II. Kind of a rascal. He'd been court-martialed 3 times in World War II. They tried to kick him out of the military, but he came back in. He went to Vietnam. And while he was there, they decided they would put portable Red Crosses on his helicopters. Now imagine that, a portable ambulance, a Red Cross on an ambulance. It was insane. But they wanted to make better use, in their judgment, of that bird. And he says, you ain't going to do it. So he set about to show that we could do what we did better than anybody else, flying at night, in weather, in all kinds of terrain, regardless of the enemy situation. He set a standard that had never been tried on the battlefield, not in Korea, not anywhere. And during the course, after about 6 months, he went into a very, very hot area to get the patients. And while he was on the ground, they came under fire. And the people on the ground started screaming at him to get out. And he said, "When I have your wounded." And those were his dying words. He took a bullet right through the heart and folded up the aircraft. Nobody else was seriously hurt. There was a physician on board. He broke his leg, but he declared Kelly dead on the spot. But those words, "When I have your wounded," set the standard up until recently. And the Dust Off pilots and Desert Storm and Just Cause and everywhere else that we've been use that as their standard. They would go no matter what. They would not leave without the patient. So he was the father of Dust Off, but it cost him his life.
Hmm.
After that, there was no more cries for portable Red Crosses.
Hmm. All right, stand by. Perfect timing on AM 1030, KVOI, Cortero, Tucson, the voice in the Perfection Auto Works studios. If you'd like to call in and ask General Brady, holder of the Medal of Honor.
I'm Oliver North, and like you, I'm listening on America Armed and Free with Charles Heller. Civilian disarmament is an essential precedent for every dictator who engages in mass murder.
If by some chance you find yourself loving me,
and welcome back to America Armed and Free, where we have the joy, the pleasure, and the special honor of having with us Major General Patrick Brady. He is of the Medal of Honor, And he speaks his book, which is very, very well done, written, co-written with his daughter, Megan Brady Smith. The book is Dead Men Flying, Victory in Vietnam, The Legend of Dust Off, America's Battlefield Angels. You talk about thinking of that music and flying the helicopter, dancing it to that song.
Yeah, I love that. I love that song because you know, as I say, my fighter pilot friends just do not like to be around helicopter pilots. We fly. You have to fly in a helicopter, both hands, both legs, fixed wings. And I'm checked out in fixed wings too. You just ride, but you become kind of. And in the book, there's a great quote from John Steinbeck and his great admiration that he had for the skill of the helicopter pilots. But you truly become one with the machine. I mean, the rhythms and the vibrations of that bird go through your body. And on occasion in Vietnam, we could, on our FM radios, which was also a homer for us, you could get music. And when they played Beautiful Balloon, I just kind of like to get in the rhythm and kind of dance through the sky. You move your feet, you move your arms and hands, and you move the bird around like you were dancing with it. It was fun. It really was. I just love that song.
You say that fighter pilots reach out and touch the face of God, but that helicopter pilots fly around God's ankles. Why do you say that?
Well, these fighter pilots with their silk scarves flying and all that. And hey, listen, lots of my friends are fighter pilots, and we have a good time with each other. But they're up there in the face of God, and the chopper pilot, he wore a hard hat. He was down in the mud and the blood, down between God's ankles, trying to pick up the patients and trying to clean out the mess and trying to land troops in combat and pick them up. And so we were workers. And the difference, we had to land. That separates the men from the boys. Now, they talk about landing on the aircraft carriers and that. You know, you land in a confined area at night in a triple canopy jungle, or pick a patient up on a hoist mission at night in the jungle or on pinnacle or anywhere where they're shooting at you. That separates the men from the boys. And they talk about mission. You know, I heard that people, fighter pilots, went home. I'm going to upset a lot of fighter pilots, I know that. But they talk about going home after 100 missions. For God's sakes, we flew 100 missions. I had 2,500 missions in 2 years, and I was just an average pilot there in terms of missions. I only had, 1,800 combat hours. And, you know, some of those kids over there flew 1,000 hours. I had two guys in my unit, Don Sewell and Steve Hall, who flew 1,000 hours in a year and more. And I'm sure there were other pilots who did a lot more than that. So the fighter pilots, they're kind of like the Marines. They get all the glamour. But the Army helicopter pilot had skills that have never, never been equaled in the air, in combat, anywhere, anytime.
You also originated a flare technique you developed for bad weather landings into mountainous terrain to pick up wounded. How did you, first of all, what is, could you describe in some detail? Remember, the vast majority of people here are not aviation, but listening, are not aviation buffs per se. They might not know what VOR meant or ILS.
Oh,
yeah. Explain in what Paul Harvey called shirt sleeve English how that technique worked, and if you would please, and if I might respectfully request you to do it that way, and also explain how you came up with it.
Well, my first tour in Vietnam, 1 year, 16,000 Americans. We carried just over 4,000 patients with 5 aircraft. That was under Charles Kelly when he was, before and after he was killed. Second tour, I came back. I got 10 pilots out of the 12 who were right out of flight school. In fact, they all graduated from flight school on the same day, 7 June 1967. And since dust-off was very demanding flying, they thought they were handpicked. They were hotshot pilots and handpicked to fly dust-off. The truth of the matter was all their names started with S. They were picked out of a block of flight school graduates and sent to me. And I had to take them to Vietnam. And when we got there in the second tour, there were 7,000 patients a month, not 4,000 a year. And dust-off had evacuated over 9,000 patients. Charles Kelly was the 149th American killed in the entire war. Now there were 16,000 dead and counting, and they were mostly being killed Over half of them were being killed at night and in weather. So I was scared to death. I'm a guy who wears my faith on my sleeve. I'm praying like crazy. I know that sooner or later they're going to be confronted with one of those missions, and it's likely to kill them. In fact, in the same unit we were in, after we had left, there was about 12 of them killed in these exact kinds of circumstances. And this is a 40-man detachment. So I didn't know what we were going to do. I'm praying like crazy. And so I get a call one night from the 101st, the Screaming Eagles, and they're out in the jungle in the mountains in a valley, a place they call Death Valley. And I head out towards them. And using techniques we'd used in the flat delta where you would, first of all, you're not authorized to fly in that kind of weather unless you're on instruments and you've got letdown facilities. Well, in Vietnam, you didn't have that. You had to fly visually as much as you could.
By letdown facilities, you mean like an ILS beacon, a beacon to home in on.
Yeah, a regular airfield.
Right.
Airfield facilities, ILS or VOR letdowns. So I start out. You know, we just ran it just like ink. And then I tried to get down on a river and follow the river using my searchlight. And it was in the middle of a tropical storm. Couldn't do anything. Now, on an earlier mission, I had been out in the valley, sitting on a mountain, watching the fight. Now, you know, this sounds crazy, but it's really beautiful. At night, the flares are coming down. You see the tracers, blue, green tracers, enemy-friendly tracers going through the sky. And it's just strangely beautiful. And we're sitting there loading the patients. And I noticed a mountaintop, and I noticed it was in the clouds, and I noticed that it was silhouetted by the flares. So fast forward now to the 101st, I'm trying to get in there, and all of a sudden I have an epiphany. The good Lord has answered my prayer. I remember that earlier mission. So I go back and get a helicopter with better instruments, and then I go into the clouds. In other words, I go up above the terrain so I don't hit any mountains. Give myself a little clearance, fly instruments into the valley, and then ask the Air Force to pop flares for me so I can follow, circle around those flares down through the mountains and get the patients. That was my vision. That was what I wanted to do and thought I could do. Now, the first time we did it, we get down to about 1,500 feet. We're in 3,000 feet mountains, and the lights go out. Forgot keep the flares going, and so, but with the Huey, you could stop it, you could hover it, and you do an instrument takeoff, which is on the instrument straight up above the mountains. Anyhow, to make a long story short, it worked. And we made four trips in there that night, and we got everybody out. Now, from that point on, we got the night weather missions solved. They can't stop us. They're not going to kill us. We're not going to kill ourselves going after patients beyond our capability at night. All we need is some flares, and they've got artillery flares, mortar flares, and they can drop flares from aircraft. So we would go out in the weather and circle down. And now, as it turned out, that had never been done before. And so although it was a violation of the instrument flying rules, nobody says anything when you're successful. Now, if I'd have been an aircraft or killed somebody that night, I'd be in jail probably. But they gave me a Distinguished Service Cross for that, the nation's second highest award. Caused a lot of fuss, but more important than that, we had a technique now to get the patient out of the field at night in weather.
Is that technique still practiced, or have modern navigational radars and improvements allowed people to do things that without using the flare?
I don't think they'd let them do it today. They're so risk averse. I've never heard of it being done since Vietnam.
Huh. Risk averse would have gotten a lot of people killed, wouldn't it?
Yes. Huh. Yes, it would. That solved the night problem, but we still had the day problem. And the solution to the day problem was another weather technique that I discovered, and it was my second epiphany, so to speak. The good Lord showed me the way to do that, and those missions resulted in the Medal of Honor.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're down to the bottom of the hour break, and I don't want to break into... I really think it would be terribly uncool for a host to interrupt a man explaining his Medal of Honor. So I think that would just be about the most uncool thing I could do, so why don't we hold that off until after the break, and I know people will be sitting on the edge of their chairs waiting, as will I. Folks, this is what radio is supposed to be with Major General Patrick Henry Brady, holder of the Medal of Honor. He's going to explain to us about those missions right after this.
Yeah. If your rights are not the fundamental sovereign measure of permissibility, then who checks or holds in balance the albatross of government?
That's a silly question. You know very well that the Obamaist administration has a czar for albatrossness.
Liberty Watch, so that government remains servant, not albatross. And America Armed and Free, about things with a muzzle, a nozzle, or a blade. Sundays, noon to 2, right after Swap Shop.
This is Aaron Simpson. You're listening to America Armed and Free. There are 45 good reasons to listen to America Armed and Free with Charles Heller.
To America Armed and Free. You might wonder, what is classical music, classical cello music, doing on a show on a military history segment about helicopter aviation? But specifically, we have with us the joy, the pleasure, and the honor of having with us General Patrick Henry Brady, author of Dead Man Flying, Victory in Vietnam, The Legend of Dust Off, America's Battlefield Angels. What was it that John Steinbeck, General Brady, said about flying a helicopter?
Well, he compared the use of the controls, the rhythms of the helicopter and the touch of the helicopter pilots and their excellence to the cello player. Is his name Casals?
Pablo Casals.
Pablo
Casals.
Yeah, and there's a great quote in my book, I don't have it in front of me, about what John Steinbeck wrote about the incredible skills of the Army helicopter pilots and how much they reminded him of that great cello player. So.
And that was a 1954 recording of Pablo Casals playing Mozart's Concerto No. 1. And that's why I wanted to, because I thought it was so well what you brought out. I'm flipping through because I think I underlined it in your book. Friends that know me get mad at me for writing in books after I was taught not to in grade school. The books were sacred. But when it comes to radio interview, you got to underline some of it. And I'm trying to find that reference to Pablo Casals.
It's in the front of the book when I talk about what a great thing it is to be one with that helicopter, and what a beautiful thing, what a beautiful machine it is.
Right. It's the page after you talk about Up, Up, and Away in My Beautiful Balloon. I know,
yeah.
I know I've seen it in there. I don't want to slow the interview down. You were going to tell us about the techniques that you came up with for daylight flying and weather, and also about your reference points. Oh, here it is. Here, may I interrupt your answer, if I may?
Please do.
This is from your book. I'm quoting you directly. This is what Steinbeck said. I wish I could tell you about these pilots. This is after he rode in a helicopter and watched them fly. They made me sick with envy. They ride their vehicles in a way a man controls a fine, well-trained quarter horse. They weave along stream beds, rise like swallows to clear the trees. They turn and twist and dip like swifts in the evening. I watch their hands and feet on the controls. The delicacy of the coordination reminds me of the sure and seeming slow hands of Pablo Casals on the cello. They are truly musicians' hands, and they play their controls like music, and they dance them like ballerinas, and they make me jealous because I just so much want to do it. That's writing. That's a journalist there. Yeah.
Isn't that, the guy could write, couldn't he? But not only that, he captured it in such a very, I don't know how many rides he had on helicopters over there, but he captured it as well as it could ever be captured. And I'm sure that the fighter pilots are green with envy listening to this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, they might get a little airsick from it. So tell us about, pardon the pun, tell us about the techniques you developed for, it wasn't quite 0-0, but it was maybe 0-25, the visibility.
Yeah.
Explain
yeah,
how was, you did that.
It's rated, as I said, the things that were killing our people were night weather and weather. Night weather and weather. And in the afternoon in Vietnam, the clouds built up over the mountaintops. The mountaintops were where the outposts were. That's where the fire support bases were. And in the morning, you had a low valley fog, which was kind of like a snowbank, and it came up about 500 feet up the side of the mountains. So those things were where, that was where the patients were going to be, and we had no letdown facilities, no navigation aids, nothing to get us in there, and still there was going to be patients there, and we'd have to go after them. One day I was called out to pick up a young soldier who'd been snake bitten. He was on an outpost on top of a mountain. And as I got to the mountain, it was enveloped in clouds, completely socked in. And I you know, there's nothing to guide me in there. I got nothing going for me in terms. So I figured, well, we'll just head up the mountain. What else can I do? So I got on the deck and I headed up the mountain. I knew if I got disoriented, I could fall out and there was valleys all around the mountain. And that's what happened. I went into it head first, just completely befuddled. As always, I'm praying like crazy, you know, Lord, why are you doing this to me? Show me the way. And then I would fall off and go around. Well, I did about three times or so, and the crew's starting to get nervous. And I said, okay, guys, and they're screaming at me up there that he's going into convulsions. So I says, guys, we got to give it one more shot, and I don't know what else we're going to do. So back up I went. Well, this time, the wind hit me, blew me sideways. That wind was the breath of God because I looked out my window, always flew with my right window down. And as I looked out, I was looking for a place to go in. I thought we were going to crash. And so I could see the tip of my rotor blade and I could see the tops of the trees. So I had two reference points. And those two reference points told me I was right side up and that I could do this thing. I could see about 20 feet to the end of the rotor blade in that stuff. So I turned that Huey, that beautiful machine, sidewards and hovered up the mountain into the area, got the kid, got him to the hospital, and we saved his life. That solved the day weather problem. You can fly in that stuff if you go at about the speed of a fast walk, fly sidewards, keep visible out your window, two reference points, whether it's the ground or a tree or whatever, and the tip of your rotor blade. And that's the technique that I used the day I got the Medal of Honor. In fact, it's probably the reason I got the medal, because the other actions were just routine, you know, minefields, enemy action type missions that we flew every day. But this one, the people who were wounded were at the bottom of a fire base, and the whole valley was socked in. And on the top of that mountain or support base was a lot of the leadership of the divisions and brigades who were in a horrible firefight that day. And they saw me. They weren't going to let me go in initially. I had to beg them to. And finally they gave me the frequency and I could then, that's all I needed. I knew where the patients were and I could go get them, did a map recon, found a route to go in there, dipped into the fog. They asked me to four aircraft to follow me in. Scared me because you get in that stuff, you know, you can only see about 20 feet and you know what those guys behind you are doing, but they all turned back. So I went, I had to make several trips in there because they told me initially there were 70 wounded. But when I came up out of the stuff from the, they were right at the bottom of the fire support base, just, you know, a couple clicks away from their headquarters where all the patients were laying in the rice paddy. And so anyhow, to make a long story short, I use that technique to get in there. But the people on the fire support base who are monitoring the mission are looking down on the fog, and they see me come up out of the fog.
Mm-hmm.
And I was told that they all broke down and started to clap. Mm-hmm. And we did it four times, and we got them all out. And by the way, we had been doing it up to that point regularly, or I had been doing it regularly with my co-pilot. And it just never got any notice. But that one, somebody saw it, and that's the way it is with medals. Somebody sees what you do, and that's the most important thing, I think, about the Medal of Honor, that your fellow soldiers thought enough of you to recommend you for it. That's the great honor, not the medal. It's a symbol. It's a symbol of the regard that your fellow soldiers have for you, and, you know, there's nothing more gratifying than to be appreciated by a fellow warrior.
Well, your fellow Medal of Honor holders appreciated you pretty well because you were president of the Medal of Honor Society, right?
Yes, I was. Yes, I was. I was. By the way, for your listeners, the Medal of Honor Society, we just lost a great one yesterday, but we're down to about 80, I'd say 80 living. When I joined, there was over 400. But we keep very, very busy.
Who did we lose?
We lost a guy named Stone, who lives in Houston, a World War II guy, a great warrior. I'm trying to think of his first name, William Stone, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And he was an older gentleman in a wheelchair last time I saw him. It's been about a year since I saw him.
Mm-hmm.
But we're all going away, and that's a good thing, because if we're all dead, there won't be any wars, maybe, and they won't be giving out that medal. But we are a busy society. We do a lot of things with young people. We have a great education program. It's online. It's free for you folks out there who want to look at it. I could go into the
Medal of Honor Society .org.
No, it would be cmoedu.org, and that'll get you our character development program. And we've got it in about 44 states and 6 countries, and we're going to get it in every school in America. And I think that Brian Williams is going to cover the program on his. He's on our board, the newspaper or the television guy.
Television guy, right?
Yeah.
If you want any public service announcements done, and you want to send me a script, I'll knock them together for you and send them to you. I do PSAs for organizations. If you're interested, we'll talk
really?
Off the. Yeah, I gladly would do that, and I'll email them all over the country for you to people if you'd like.
Beautiful, beautiful. We're working hard on that program, but Brian Williams will do a. It's going to be on Hard Rock Central, I think, and it's going to be sometime later this month, and be a great thing for the vignettes. We use Medal of Honor. Things to teach about the importance of courage, about sacrifice, how you define a hero, who America's nobility.
How do you define a hero?
Well, let me tell you, let me just give you an example. I don't know how much time we got, but my personal hero is a guy named Pappy Coleman. Pappy Coleman was my medic in Vietnam. Pappy Coleman at one time got out of the helicopter to go get the wounded, and he got shot in the chicken plate, knocked him down, got up, shot, knocked him down. He finally figured out where the guy was shooting at him. He killed the guy and kept on going. Another mission, he takes a bullet right between his lips. And the crew chief jumped on him to stop the blood, and Pappy says, "Not to worry, I just kissed the bullet that had my name on it." He jumped up and went back to kill. The next mission, he's with me in the rice paddy, or in the minefield the day I got the medal. And nobody will move in a minefield, except I told my crew to go get the patients. They jumped out and started carrying them back to the aircraft. Nobody would help them load. Nobody would move because there had been a bunch of people wounded and a bunch of people killed in that minefield. And one other aircraft had already left. So they're getting close to the end, and they step on a mine, and they're right under my rotor blade. And so I saw him go up in the air. I thought he was going to go through the rotor blades, and Pappy landed. He's on fire. His pants are on fire, puts it out, and continues to load the patients. I take him to the hospital. Now, why is Pappy a hero? Pappy's a hero, certainly courageous, 3 Silver Stars, 3 Purple Hearts, but the guy had 18 years of service. He's 2 years short of retirement. He gave up his pension because his family called him home to take care of them, his grandchildren, his children, and his wife. He gave it up. The whole thing. He would have been a sergeant major in the Army for sure. Could have been sergeant major of the Army.
Hmm.
So why is Pappy a hero? Because he's a good person. Celebrities are heroes to too many people, and celebrities are not good people always. Goodness is essential to heroism. And Pappy Coleman epitomizes the true hero because he is a good person. So we can't have heroes who are not good people, and we need to emulate you know, a celebrity is somebody we want to meet. A hero should be somebody we want to be like. And Pappy Coleman, and by the way, we just put him in the Aviation Hall of Fame, the Army Aviation Association Hall of Fame.
Perfect timing. We're up on that last break of the hour. General Brady, please stand by for just a little bit. Hop on. Dust off 5-5. You have a mission. Welcome back. Last segment of America Armed and Free with General Patrick Henry Brady, holder of the Medal of Honor for one day of missions and really a lifetime in a year tour, or just a 10-month tour, I believe, of missions saving thousands and thousands of people's lives. And can you tell from the sound what model it is, or is it not? Is the sound not? Yeah, I know it was a Huey, but yeah. I don't know if you can.
No, you can't tell. My ears are not very good, but for music or anything else, we wore helmets that didn't protect our ears. But all the Hueys, I think, because of the dual blades, two blades, had the same sound. It was therapeutic, believe it or not, for Vietnam veterans at VA hospital in the state of Washington, where they would hear those Huey helicopters, and they noticed that the patients stopped everything when they heard those Huey helicopters, and so they actually took them to the airfield so that they could be around that Huey to feel it, to get in it, and everything. It was everything to the GI in Vietnam: food, wound, if he was wounded, if he needed supplies. They took him into battle, they took him out. So that Huey is everything to the Vietnam veteran.
All right, if you're on hold, hold on. Mark, a both fixed-wing and rotary pilot from the Air Force, you're on with General Patrick Henry Brady. Please be concise.
Yeah, very honored to speak with you there. And I trained with the Army, even though I was an Air Force helicopter pilot. And one of the things my Army instructors who I flew with said was when they were in Vietnam, they flew with the thing we called force trim turned off, so they could feel the hydraulics. Is that something that you did too, or did you have any comment on it?
Absolutely. Some pilots would fly with the force trim on, which to me took away the entire feel of the aircraft. So I never used the force trim. Now, if you let go of the cyclic with the force trim off, that thing just flops like a noodle. So it could be very, very dangerous. So I did that. I never used the force trim. Now, if you're going cross country or something and you're up in safe country and everything, you can put the force trim on and just cruise along. It ain't a big deal. But when you're making an approach into the jungle or something like that, where you need to feel everything, even the bullets going through the aircraft, if you're not really, you may not even notice them sometimes, unless you got that force trim on. So, yes, I flew without it.
Yeah, it seemed to be consistent there. In the Air Force, they kind of demanded that we fly with force trim, but our missions are a little bit different, not quite as heat of the battle. Again, an honor to speak with you, and thanks for being on the radio.
Thank you.
General Brady, very briefly, you were talking about some of the particular maneuvers. One of them was what you called the death spiral, and there was a second maneuver about coming in without flaring. Could you really briefly explain that for us, the way it worked?
I was on approach one day. I was on my second aircraft. We had lost the first one to hydraulics in the field, made a force landing, got another bird. I'm on approach, and my co-pilot gets shot. Now, these people are in a tree line, and off to the side of the tree line is an open rice paddy with rice burns. And I'm making a normal approach, just coming out straight down into the area. He gets shot, so I go take him to the hospital. I get another aircraft to go back, and I say, I don't want to do that again. I can't do that. So I put the enemy's eyeballs in my sockets, and I tried to visualize what he could see if he was in that tree line on the edge of those rice paddies. And I was coming in, and I figured it out. If I got down on the deck, behind those rice barrens and came in low level in that elephant grass, I might be able to get in there if I snaked my way in and had a good signal, good registration points on the way in, because you lose sight of everything when you get down on the deck, that I could probably get in there and get out without, before he really noticed I was there. And it worked. Now, I had gunship escort on that mission because they were already in the area, and the gunship pilots got shot up. We got out with the patients, and I used that low, fast approach from then on. Some helicopters will tell you when you come to a stop, you flare, side flare, straight in flare. I hated the flare because it puts you in a float at about 50 feet where the controls were no use to you until you finally settled to the ground and you were sitting duck. So I came in flat and fast, and by cross-controlling and turning the bird, I could stop it from a high speed and be headed the way you want to go out. You always wanted to turn your tail into the enemy fire because it's harder for the bullets to get through you.
Right, it has to go through the transmission to hit you.
You bet.
Yeah. All right, and Bill, you're live on America Armed and Free. Fast question for General Brady.
General Brady, first of all, God bless you for the lives you saved back there. And my question is, real briefly, is what your opinion is of this Benghazi incident, how the administration has handled it. And I'll just take my answer on the air. I'm going to hang up. Thank you.
Okay, you bet. Good question, because it has a lot to do with Dustoff. And we heard the other day Secretary Panetta talk about the Obama-Panetta doctrine, says you don't go in harm's way unless you know what's going on. Now, when he was talking about Benghazi, if they didn't know what was going on, how did they know they were going into harm's way? And if we use that doctrine in Dustoff, or if we used it in Normandy, for God's sakes, we would have never landed, or Incheon, we would have never landed. You go into harm's way if somebody's harmed. That's the mission. All our wars were based on saving people's lives, saving a people. And so if Dustoff used that as the standard, we would have never launched, because we went into harm's way on a daily basis, as did all the troops in Vietnam, to help those helpless people. And we did it without regard to harm's way. People are obsessed with risk, and today risk comes before the patient. Risk analysis, which is a crazy system they use today. Now, how are you going to evaluate risk in combat? Medium, high, low? It's insane. But they try to do it, and they've got algorithms that they, and what it does is waste time. In Vietnam, we were off the ground in 2 minutes and on the way to the patient. Today, it's 15 and longer. Can you imagine a fire truck taking 15 minutes to get underway to a fire? It's crazy.
Well, he's got to stop and renew his insurance policy.
Yes, yes. Or call ahead and say, you know, how hot is the fire? It's just insane where this is coming from and who these people are. I have no idea, but it's something we never confronted. Thank God we never confronted this in Vietnam, or we certainly would not have been, you know, my unit with 3 flyable aircraft, 40 men, 26 Purple Hearts. We carried over 21,000 patients in 9.5 months. Could never done that if we wasted time in analyzing risk. The pilot analyzes the risk in conjunction with the guy on the ground when he gets there.
All right, we're down to the last minute or so. Did you want to, the website for the Medal of Honor, Lessons of Personal Bravery, Lessons of Personal Bravery, is, once again, folks, if you want,
CMOHEDU.org.
Yeah, CMOHEDU.org. And it's a wonderful way to learn about lessons of honor and courage and other things. I really appreciate you taking the time to be with us, General Brady, and I will contact you off the air about the public service announcements for your organization. The book is Dead Men Flying, Victory in Vietnam, co-written with Megan Brady Smith, his daughter. Phenomenal read, and really explains both the technical and also the human side. I really appreciate you taking the time to be with us, General Brady.
You bet. It's my pleasure. And they can get the book at my website, too, generalbrady.com.
Generalbrady.com. Got it. Thank you for your service to the country, not only in combat, but also afterwards, speaking so well for the service of others. I really appreciate it. Have a great day.
Thank you.
You're
welcome. Thank you, Charles.
You're welcome. I'm going to let that one stand. Have a great day. We sing. Long may our land be bright with freedom.